All right, let's dive in today. We're tackling a property law puzzler that I'm sure every law student listening has come across at some point.
It's a classic.
It is. We're looking at Bomar v. Eccles,
right,
a case from 1978 that grapples with a question that, honestly, can make your head spin a little.
Yeah.
Can unwritten, like unspoken understandings about how land can be used in a neighborhood actually restrict what an owner can do, even if it's not like officially written down on their deed?
It really gets at, you know, that core tension that runs through so much of property law.
Yeah, yeah.
The idea that, okay, we want to let people use their land freely, right? That's kind of like a bedrock principle.
Okay, okay.
But at the same time, we also want some predictability. We want to uphold, you know, what the community expects. So it's like, how do you balance those? How do you balance those two things?
That's a tough one.
It is. In this case, it throws it into sharp relief. Imagine you're, I don't know, advising a client who's, say, a law student, right? They're super excited. They're looking at buying some land. They do their due diligence, get the title search back. Everything looks clean.
Awesome.
Right. No problems. Good to go. And then out from the woodwork come the neighbors.
Oh.
And they're like, hold on a second. There's this understanding, this longstanding thing here, that this whole area is only for houses.
Really?
Even though, right, even though it's not actually spelled out on the deed for this specific piece of property.
That's wild. So just to really paint the picture for our listeners.
Yeah.
Imagine you've closed on this, like what you thought was your perfect piece of property.
Dream property.
Dream property. Be totally clear. There's no weird strings attached.
You're golden.
Right. And then all of a sudden, your plans are, like, totally derailed.
Screeching halt.
Yeah, because, turns out, years and years ago, the original developer put residential restrictions on, like, some of the lots in the development, but not all of them.
Right.
How on earth can those old restrictions suddenly apply to your land, which, according to your deed, is totally unrestricted?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the legal knot we're going to try and untangle today with Bomar v. Eccles.
So in this deep dive, we really want to get into these things called reciprocal negative easements.
Okay.
Because that's the mechanism at play here. We need to understand, you know, like, how do these implied restrictions, these things that aren't written down, how can they actually bind property owners?
Right.
And probably even more importantly, how hard is it to prove that they even exist in the first place?
Okay.
So we're going to really dig into the South Carolina Supreme Court's decision in Bomar. And we've also got a really helpful case brief that lays it all out. So we're going to use that, too, to make sure we hit all the, you know, the key points that you as future lawyers really need to grasp.
Awesome. So, like, to really grasp the legal arguments and everything, let's back up a little bit and set the stage, you know, the backstory.
Okay.
It all starts with this big chunk of land.
Okay.
Owned by a guy named A.H. Vaughn. And this property eventually ends up in the hands of his son, Grover.
Right.
So between 1953 and 1959, Grover starts selling off pieces of this land, like 6 different parcels.
Okay.
And the really important thing is that the deeds for each of these 6 lots.
Yeah.
They had very clear, very explicit restrictions that basically said, this land can only be used for residential purposes.
Okay. Got it.
Houses. That's it.
Okay.
But here's where things get a little messy, you know. Grover didn't put these restrictions on every single part of the original land. He held on to some of it.
Mm.
And when he or his wife later sold those pieces, the deeds for those sales, including the 40 acres that our defendant, Albert Eccles, eventually buys in 1974.
Right, right.
Those deeds said absolutely nothing about any restrictions.
Ah, okay. So you've got this mix.
I guess, yes.
Some with restrictions, some without.
Exactly.
Interesting.
So fast forward to 74, Eccles buys his 40 acres.
Yeah.
Deeds quiet, you know, no restrictions mentioned. And he's all set to start developing a mobile home subdivision.
Makes sense.
Yeah. But, you know, as you can probably guess, that's when the owners of those original 6 lots, the ones with the recorded restrictions, they step in.
They're not happy.
Not happy. They're arguing that even though Eccles' deed doesn't say it, his land should still be subject to this kind of, like, implied restriction.
Okay.
A reciprocal negative easement, they called it, which would basically block him from building the mobile home park.
So that's the legal heart of the matter, right?
Right.
Can restrictions that are written down, specifically included in some deeds that all came from the same seller, in this case, Grover Vaughn,
right,
can those be, like, stretched, extended, applied to someone who later buys a different part of that original land,
yeah.
even if their own deed is totally silent on those restrictions?
Tough question.
It is. The neighbors are basically saying, look, Grover Vaughn had this general plan for the whole area. It was supposed to be all residential.
In the Nichols, yeah.
Yeah, you're messing it all up with your mobile homes. So it's this idea of an unspoken agreement that they're trying to enforce.
And what happened at the trial level?
Well, the trial court actually sided with the neighbors.
Wow.
They issued an injunction, put the brakes on Eccles' development.
Good.
But of course, that wasn't the end of the story.
No.
That's why we're here.
Exactly. Eccles, he wasn't giving up. He appealed. And the case went up to the South Carolina Supreme Court.
Right.
So now the Supreme Court's got to grapple with this whole idea of implied restrictions.
Hmm.
You know, how do you legally establish that these unwritten rules should actually apply to a property owner?
Big questions.
Big questions. And that's where this legal doctrine, reciprocal negative easements, comes
yeah,
in.
Exactly.
And the court, they laid out what's become like this famous four-part test to figure out if such an easement actually exists.
Right. This is crucial stuff.
This is big.
Okay.
Okay, so let's break down this four-part test, like step by step. So for the neighbors to win, to prove that Eccles' land was actually bound by these like secret restrictions, they had to meet four conditions.
Four hurdles to clear.
Exactly. First, yeah, there had to be a common grantor.
Okay.
Basically, one person who sold all the relevant pieces of land. In the Bomar case, that's pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
It was Grover Vaughn. He's the guy who sold off all the parcels we're talking about.
Right. So check mark on number one.
Check. Okay, number two. They had to show that there was land, specifically designated land, that was meant to be subject to these restrictions.
Okay.
In this case, that would be those initial six lots that Grover Vaughn sold,
yeah,
with those very specific residential restrictions written right into the deeds.
Oh, okay, makes sense.
Right, so far, so good for the neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
But number three, this is where things start to get really tricky for them.
Oh.
They had to prove that there was this general plan or scheme of development for the whole entire Vaughn tract of land.
Uh-huh.
Basically, they had to show that Grover Vaughn, from the very beginning, intended for all of the parcels, even the ones he sold later, without those explicit restrictions, to be bound by the same limitations.
So even the ones where he didn't write it down, they're saying he still meant it to apply.
Yes. And the South Carolina Supreme Court, they were not buying it.
Really?
Yeah. They looked at the evidence and they said, wait a minute. Six out of the 14 conveyances, the sales, that Grover Vaughn made had these residential restrictions.
Okay.
But a majority, eight of them, didn't.
Hmm.
And there's no overall plat, no big document that outlines a uniform plan for developing this whole property. They were basically saying, look, if Grover Vaughn really wanted this whole area to be only houses, why did he leave so many of the deeds unrestricted?
Right.
That inconsistency, it was a huge problem for the court.
It does kind of poke holes in the argument.
Yeah, right. It wasn't like every single lot he sold had that same restriction. It was this like mix and match situation. And that really weakened the neighbor's argument that there was this clear overarching plan from the get-go.
Right, right. It makes it look a lot less intentional.
Exactly. Okay, and then the fourth and final part of the test is that these covenants, these restrictions, they have to run with the land.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Legally is alert.
But
what it basically means is that the restrictions aren't just meant to apply to the original buyer.
Mm-hmm.
But to anyone who owns the property later on, too.
Okay.
Like a promise, you know, attached to the land itself.
Travels with it.
Yeah. So even when the property is sold to someone new, that promise, that restriction sticks with it.
I see.
So when you look at all four parts of the test together, the Supreme Court and Bomar, they really zeroed in on that third part, the whole general plan thing.
Makes sense. That was the shaky one.
It was.
Yeah.
And they basically decided that the neighbors, they just didn't present enough evidence to back up their claim.
Mm.
And this is where it gets really interesting, I think.
Yeah.
Because you can see how the court's decision was shaped by these bigger policy ideas.
Oh, absolutely.
They were really emphasizing that, in general, the law doesn't like restrictions on how property owners can use their land.
Makes sense.
You know, they even quoted this line that restrictions like these have to be plain and unmistakable.
No guessing games.
No guessing. They were really serious about that. And this reluctance, I think, it comes from this very fundamental principle in property law.
Yeah.
The idea that land should be freely alienable.
Right.
Meaning that owners should generally be able to use their property however they want.
Freedom to use your land.
Yes. And if you want to put limits on that, right, you got to be super clear about it.
No ambiguity.
Right. To prevent disputes later on and just for the sake of efficiency, you know.
Makes sense.
So the court, they were really leaning towards this idea that you should be able to use your land however you want, unless there's a super obvious, super clear agreement saying otherwise.
Right.
It's almost like they're saying, look, if you want to limit what someone can do with their property, you got to spell it out in writing. No ifs, ands, or buts.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't just rely on these like unspoken understandings or a bunch of random restrictions scattered across different properties.
No, piecing it together.
Exactly. So, and I know this is hypothetical, but just to illustrate the point. Imagine if Grover Vaughn had done things differently from the start.
Okay.
Like, what if he had recorded a subdivision plat, you know, one of those maps that shows all the lots, and on that plat, it clearly said, all the lots are residential only houses.
Right.
Or if every single deed he issued, you know, they all had the same exact language about these residential restrictions.
Okay.
The outcome of Bomar V. Eccles could have been totally different.
Ah, interesting.
Like, imagine how frustrated the neighbors must have been.
Right.
They bought their property thinking this was going to be a quiet residential community.
Mm-hmm.
And then, bam, they're facing a potential mobile home park.
Not what they signed up for.
Nope. But it highlights, I think, a really key takeaway from this case.
Yeah.
Courts are super hesitant to restrict someone's property rights based on just, like, implications on assumptions.
I want proof.
Solid proof. They want clear, undeniable evidence of what the original intent was.
Right.
So in the end, the South Carolina Supreme Court, they reversed the lower court's decision.
Okay.
Albert Eccles, he got the green light to go ahead with his mobile home park.
Wow.
Because the neighbors just couldn't meet that high burden of proof.
They couldn't prove that there was this really clear, plain, and unmistakable general plan of restriction that applied to the entire Vaughn tract.
Okay, so for all of you future lawyers out there listening, what are the big practical lessons from Bomar V. Eccles?
Good question.
I think the most important one is this. When you're drafting those restrictive covenants, those limitations on property use, be super precise.
Yeah.
Don't leave any wiggle room, you know.
No ambiguity.
Clearly define exactly which properties those restrictions apply to, what they are, and how long they're going to last.
Spell it all out.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, I mean, this is maybe obvious, but if you're ever involved in a legal fight over these implied restrictive covenants, whether you're trying to enforce them or fight against them,
mm-hmm.
Bomar gives you a roadmap.
It does.
It shows how important it is to look carefully at the entire chain of title, the history of ownership, including all the deeds and any recorded development plans.
Yeah.
You need hard evidence to prove that there was this general scheme of development in place.
Right, right.
And don't forget, just because some properties in a development have restrictions doesn't automatically mean all of them do.
No assumptions.
You got to show that the original developer had this clear, undeniable intention to restrict the whole area.
Okay, and remember that four-part test we talked about?
Yes.
Common grantor, designated restricted land, a genuine general plan that is crystal clear, and covenants that run with the land.
Boom.
That's your foundation for analyzing these kinds of cases.
It's really interesting to think about how things have changed since 1978, you know, when Bomar was decided.
Oh, yeah.
We've got HOAs now, homeowners associations everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And they have these super detailed, super specific covenants that are like meticulously recorded.
Right.
And I think part of that is to avoid the exact kind of mess we saw in Bomar.
They're trying to head it off at the pass.
Yeah. But it makes me wonder, does this big shift towards these like explicit comprehensive restrictions,
yeah,
is it actually a better way to balance individual property rights with, you know, the goals of community planning?
Interesting question.
Or does it create like a whole new set of complications and potential problems that, well, maybe we'll have to explore in another deep dive sometime?
Maybe we will.
Something to think about. All right, that's it for today's deep dive. We'll see you next time.